From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Ever since World War II, we have grappled with how to prevent a nuclear war. Journalist Strobe Talbot has covered arms control for Time magazine for more than a decade, and he's just written a book about one of its key players, veteran arms negotiator Paul Nitze. On today's Fresh Air, Talbot discusses the current state of arms control. In the comedy Lip Service, Griffin Dunne plays the flamboyantly vapid host of a morning TV talk show. Paul Dooley plays the more mature but terminally dull co-host. Today we talk with the writer of this HBO presentation, Howard Korter. And we have reviews of the new jazz album from composer John Carter and of 60 Minutes' 20th anniversary shows. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Strobe Talbot is Time magazine's Washington bureau chief and a specialist in U.S.-Soviet relations and arms control. His 1984 book, Deadly Gambits, uncovered the power struggles and personality conflicts in the Reagan administration that helped bring about a breakdown in arms negotiations with the Soviets. Talbot's new book, The Master of the Game, is a history of arms negotiations focusing on Paul Nitze. Nitze has advised every president since Franklin Roosevelt, including President Reagan. In 1982, Paul Nitze broke loose from the formalized bureaucratic arms control negotiations process to take a walk in the woods with his Soviet counterpart. Nitze played a key role in crafting the recent treaty with the Soviets on intermediate-range nuclear forces. Many people are profoundly concerned about the threat of nuclear war, but find it difficult to follow detailed tactical discussions about arms control. And it's very frustrating to find yourself confused by the discussion of something you desperately want to understand. I asked Strobe Talbot if it's sometimes frustrating for him to cover the intricacies of arms control.
It's both a frustration, but it's also an opportunity and a professional challenge. It's really what I care most about in my work as a journalist, because I see myself as a layman who is trying through journalism to help other laymen understand what, as you say, is an extremely important but complex and somewhat inaccessible subject.
Does the story get more complex as time goes on and as more weapons are made? The more weapons, the more complex the story.
Yes, and afraid, bad news for my fellow laymen, that it's about to get more complex again in the next administration, because up until now, the subject of nuclear arms control has been precisely that. It's been the subject of nuclear arms control. And the other kinds of arms control that we have to worry about, particularly the control of non-nuclear or so-called conventional weapons, that's kind of a misnomer because they can still do an awful lot of damage. A very non-conventional damage in a lot of cases. But conventional arms control is looming up as the next big headache for policymakers and for generals and therefore for citizens to think about and for journalists like me to write about. And conventional arms control makes nuclear arms control look simple in many ways.
Why is that?
Because conventional arms control involves... first of all, trying to deal with weapons which don't have the quality of apocalyptic destruction and Armageddon about them that nuclear weapons do, and therefore it's harder to generate the kind of interest in them as something, as a kind of an absolute evil that must be contained. I mean, conventional weapons, after all, are things like tanks and airplanes with bombs on them, and even for that matter, common soldiers with rifles, and those are weapons which have been used throughout the centuries, and therefore they don't have the quality that nuclear weapons have of being something so dreadful that for them to be used at all would be the end of the world. It's a little harder to generate the kind of emotive reaction that nuclear arms control generates. Also, it's much, much more difficult to control weapons which are exist in the many thousands in the arsenals of virtually every country on Earth.
Well, we've never really entered into negotiations about conventional arms before, have we?
Well, we have, and it hasn't been a very inspiring or confidence-producing exercise. There have been negotiations going on under the not very memorable initials of MBFR, for Mutual and Balanced Force Reductions, in Vienna for many years now. And it's been an exercise in frustration, They haven't produced very much, and the public hasn't taken much interest in it. But those negotiations, the mutual and balanced force reduction talks, probably under another name and operating under different auspices and different rules, are going to move, if not front and center, then at least they are going to share the spotlight with the strategic arms reduction talks and the more traditional, well-known, and popularly more supported nuclear arms control negotiations in the next 4 to 8 years.
Just one more question on this subject. Does this indicate that we've made a lot of progress in nuclear arms control and that's why conventional weapons are entering in?
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. That's a particularly optimistic way to put it. But
What's the other way?
Yeah, well, the other way is that we have to start dealing with conventional weapons because, as some people have put it, and kind of half jokingly, we now have to start dealing with weapons that can really hurt people. Nuclear weapons, you see, have this dimension of unusability about them, and that, in some ways, makes them easier to negotiate about than conventional weapons, which, as I said earlier, have been used to kill people, and are being used to kill people all the time right now. But the reason that the issue of conventional arms control is coming front and center has to do with a large degree of success, particularly in the last couple of years in nuclear arms control. As we eliminate an entire category of nuclear weapons, which is what President Reagan and General Secretary Gorbachev did with the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or Zero Option Agreement, in December of 1987. The nuclear ingredient or nuclear component of deterrence, that is the system whereby the superpowers avoid going to nuclear war, is diminished. There is less reliance on nuclear weapons to deter these two countries from going to war, and therefore there has to be greater attention paid by diplomats and generals and statesmen to the role of conventional weapons in keeping the peace between the superpowers. And in the strategic realm, that is in the area of negotiations over weapons which can fly from one continent to the other, there is now serious talk about reducing those arsenals, at least some categories of those arsenals, by 50%. And that once again puts more of the onus of deterring war between the superpowers on the conventional balance, the balance of terror not in nuclear weapons but in conventional weapons.
Strobe Talbott is my guest. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for Time Magazine and the author of the new book, The Master of the Game. Your new book is basically a history of arms control negotiations, focusing on the work of one man, Paul Nitze. I'd like for you to tell the story about how we were first introduced to his existence. And this goes back to when you were in school during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right. In the preface to the book, I tell a story about how I first heard of Paul Nitze. I was 16 years old at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, and I was a student at a prep school in Connecticut. And it happens to have been the prep school that Paul Nitze himself went to, the Hotchkiss School up in the northwest corner of Connecticut. And during the Cuban Missile Crisis, all of the students were summoned into the school chapel, and we literally got down on our knees and prayed for the survival of the country and the human race. And I think scenes like that were taking place all over the country and to some extent all over the world. And because Paul Nitze was an alumnus of the school and had been involved closely as an advisor to President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was subsequently given an award by the school, and I became very interested in him at about the same time that I became interested in Soviet-American relations and nuclear diplomacy.
Do you think there's certain values that he stands for in the history of arms negotiations?
Values and themes. I see him as a personification of what has been a continuing concern on the part of many American experts on foreign relations and defense, and that is a concern with the theoretical vulnerability of the United States to an attack by the Soviet Union. And this has been one of the big concerns, not just of right-wingers by any means, but of a lot of serious people who have been trying to make policy over the years. He is one of those who's been afraid that if given a chance, the Soviet Union might strike first and attack the United States with its nuclear weapons. And even if it did not do so, that the theoretical ability to carry out such an attack represented a major political vulnerability for the United States.
Politically, Nitzer worked both for Democratic and Republican administrations, yet he was distrusted by both conservatives and liberals. Would you explain that?
Yeah, and I don't regard that necessarily as a criticism of Nitzer. I think that probably means that in some ways he's got it about right, that he would be distrusted and resented by the left wing and many liberals for being too harsh in his view of the Soviet Union. And at the same time, he's criticized by the right wing for being too willing to engage in diplomacy with the Soviet Union. But so, in other words, he is in some ways a man of the center who quite naturally would come under attack from the two extremes. But it hasn't just been under the from the extremes that he has been criticized. It's also been from people who felt that he has gone too far in his attacks on the government as a whole, and also in his attacks on individuals, including former colleagues of his who have ended up inside the governments when he's been left on the outside. The classic example was his savage attack bordering on character assassination of Paul Warnke, a man who had worked for him in the Pentagon and to whom he'd been very close and who was then Jimmy Carter's chief arms control negotiator. And Nitzer was absolutely vicious and savage in the way he attacked Warnke.
It was Nitzer who took the now celebrated walk in the woods with his Soviet counterpart during arms negotiations. You call that one of the most creative acts of insubordination in the history of diplomacy.
Yes, I'm an admirer of Nitzer for what he tried to do in that instance as well as others, where it was clear to him, and I think he was quite right, that the government for which he was working, the Reagan administration, had gotten itself paralyzed, primarily by internal disagreements over how to proceed. So Paul Nitzer set about to try to see if he could break the logjam that had developed in the negotiations on his own and then sell it to his home government. He failed in the famous case of the walk in the woods, which was an effort to break a logjam that had developed in the intermediate range nuclear forces talks. And he failed, I think, gloriously, as it were. On another case, a couple of years later, when he tried to develop a compromise in the strategic arms negotiations. But in trying to do so, he helped get the process going again in both cases.
In what way was he reprimanded by the Reagan administration for this walk in the woods?
I'm sorry, why or how?
How?
Well, he was reprimanded with, in effect, a letter of reprimand in his file. The National Security Council staff sent a letter to Secretary of State George Shultz that basically said Nitzer had better not wander off into the woods again with a Soviet counterpart unless making sure that he had permission to do so from the White House.
I want to ask you about the Strategic Defense Initiative, also known in the vernacular as Star Wars. In the now best-selling book Landslide, a story is told about how President Reagan was introduced to the Strategic Defense Initiative and why he was so excited by it. And I'd like to ask you if this jives with what you know of the story. The story, as it's told in Landslide, basically, is that the physicist Edward Teller got a special meeting with President Reagan without Reagan's aides knowing that this meeting was going to happen, that Teller basically sold the president on an idea of this protective nuclear shield. The president loved the idea and, in spite of his aide's advice, pushed for it, and that's how it became part of the nuclear agenda. Does that jive with the story that you know?
There's no question that Edward Teller, who is not only the intellectual godfather of Star Wars, or SDI, but also the father of the American hydrogen bomb, played a critical role in implanting this idea in President Reagan's mind. In fact, he had really started to do so before President Reagan assumed the presidency. The idea really has its roots back when President Reagan was the governor of California, And when he learned for the first time that the United States had no means of defending itself against any level of enemy attack. Now, on the question of whether the president's other aides oppose this or not, that gets to be quite complicated. It's a story I tell at some length in my book, because some of the president's aides, particularly Robert McFarlane, who was first the deputy national security advisor and later the national security advisor, thought that it would be a good idea for the president to propose the Star Wars program because this would put the fear of God into the Soviets. It would scare the Soviets with the possibility of American technological superiority, which the Soviets regard as a kind of black magic, being unleashed, and that it would end up putting the Soviets at a disadvantage to the United States. McFarlane's hope was that the Soviets would be sufficiently frightened by this prospect that they would make major concessions in their level of strategic offensive weaponry in order to make sure that there were constraints on American defensive technology. Mr. McFarland called this idea that of using of SDI as the greatest sting operation in history. Now, it subsequently got out of his control. Hawks in the Pentagon particularly seized on SDI, and instead of using it as a kind of giant bargaining chip, tried to treat it as something which could not be negotiated at all under any circumstances. They treated it as kind of as the family jewels, which had to be protected in any negotiations.
I want to talk with you more about SDI, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Strobe Talbott, the Washington bureau chief for Time magazine. His new book is titled The Master of the Game. It's a history of American arms control diplomacy, focusing on the work of arms negotiator Paul Nitze. Strobe Talbott has covered arms control issues for over a decade. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Strobe Talbott is my guest. You were talking about the Strategic Defense Initiative and how some people in the administration, the Reagan administration, wanted to use it as a bargaining chip. Did anybody in the Reagan administration, besides the president himself, actually believe that SDI was a workable plan, that if we spent enough money on research, we could actually create something like SDI?
Well, Terry, your question goes to the heart of one of the problems with SDI, which is, what is it that we're talking about here? Does SDI mean, as the president indicated in his original speech on the subject in March 1983, an impregnable, comprehensive defensive shield which will, as he put it, render offensive nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete? In other words, that will allow us to do away, will force us to do away with all offensive weapons. If that's what you mean by SDI, then I think it's safe to say that virtually nobody, with the possible exception of Nancy, perhaps, in the administration, believed in that dream. Nobody shared the president's utopian notion that with this kind of technological magic wand, we could make offensive weapons disappear. There were and remain, however, many people, both inside the government and out, who believe that some level of strategic defense is a good idea, that we ought to not be completely naked to our enemies, as it were. We shouldn't be completely vulnerable to an attack, even a limited attack or an accidental attack or an attack fired on us by a third world madman of some kind.
But that's not what was sold to the public.
Exactly. And that's the point. I think one reason that the president's original idea was so appealing to people is that the American people, for very understandable reasons, some of them visceral and some of them intellectual and all of them moral, do not like the idea of basing the nuclear peace, as I call it, on the notion of a kind of global suicide pact. The threat that if our enemy, the Soviet Union, makes one false move, will not only blow him to smithereens, but will blow the world up. That is a very difficult notion to stomach. It's the notion that's been called sardonically by the experts, including experts who believe in it, mutual assured destruction. And when the president gets up and says, I have a better idea, let's base the nuclear peace on a benign system, an anti-weapon system rather than a weapon system, it has a lot of appeal.
But it wasn't truth in advertising.
I think it was truth in advertising as far as the president was concerned, but it was used very cynically by a lot of other people. In other words, these Pentagon hawks that I referred to earlier, particularly Caspar Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, who seized upon SDI and overcame their own initial skepticism about the program and used it as a kind of as a blocking mechanism to make sure that there was no progress in arms control, they certainly are guilty of falsity in advertising.
You write that the story of SDI was largely the story of Nitz's tenacity and ingenuity on behalf of the progress in arms control.
One of the reasons I selected Paul Nitze as a subject for the book was that he did not enter the scene on this issue at the beginning of the Reagan administration. He has been a constant protagonist in this field since the very beginning of the nuclear age. He was a part of earlier governments that formulated the policy of nuclear deterrence, and he knew essentially that the presidential notion of SDI was naive and simplistic, although he has been very careful never to use those terms, and he tried to make the best of a bad situation. The phrase he did use was to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, and to use SDI to give some impetus to the negotiations that would produce a strategic arms agreement.
Where does SDI stand now?
Well, it still exists as a research program, which, by the way, was the form that it took before the president gave his Star Wars speech. The notion of trying to see if we couldn't come up with a high-tech fix to the problem of the vulnerability of our missiles in laboratories has been around for a very long time. There was an SDI, although not under those initials, back at the time of the Carter administration and even earlier. I think what's happening now is that SDI is coming full circle. It is returning to the status that it had before the president slapped these dramatic promises on it, and now people are realizing that those promises probably were false to begin with.
Is there a lot of money being spent now on research for SDI?
Not as much as the Pentagon would like, not as much as the enthusiasts for SDI would like, more than some of the critics would like. My own guess is that for a variety of reasons, either a Bush or a Dukakis administration would probably end up spending more or less the same amount on SDI. And one reason for that, of course, is that we're living in a Graham-Rudman era in which there just isn't the kind of billions around that the enthusiasts would want, but also because the advisors both to a President Bush or a President Dukakis would see SDI in about the same light. And that is a program which should be pursued in the laboratory to see if there's something there that might someday be deployed, but we shouldn't prejudge the issue of whether the research will eventually produce something that will genuinely contribute to peace and deterrence the way the president did, this president, President Reagan.
Your 1984 book, Deadly Gambits, was about behind-the-scenes power struggles in the Reagan administration over arms control. And you end Deadly Gambits with this sentence: the Reagan revolution in arms control was over. Well, now we're in 1988. The Reagan administration is drawing to a close. The INF treaty was signed at the end of 1987. What's your final summation of the Reagan administration's work in arms control?
That the Reagan administration, particularly in the last couple of years, has indeed left the Reagan revolution behind and brought the leadership of this country back to a point that demonstrates a lot of continuity with the past, both over how nuclear arms control should be pursued and also how the nuclear peace should be maintained. And that's once again why I chose Nitze as the subject for the book, because he is the personification of continuity from one administration to the next, and he was also a key instrument in bringing this administration from some of its more radical and unpromising premises back to a point where they can pass on to the next administration a legacy that does indeed have a lot of continuity with the past.
Investigations into current campaigning indicate that we are really seeing media advisors manipulating the candidates to an unprecedented degree. Do you think that this is interfering with the candidates' willingness to discuss arms control in the campaign?
Yes, that has certainly been a problem. It has been, I think, almost without precedent, a campaign of cynicism and symbolism of a very cheap kind. And it's been very, very hard for substance to work its way through all of the nonsense that's been flying around in the air. Arms control is under a particular disadvantage because, unlike in 1984, when there was a lot of suspense about what was going to happen in arms control, in 1988, I think there's a sense, first of all, that a major agreement has been reached, the INF Treaty, another agreement, the START Treaty, is in prospect, and second, that arms control is no longer the be-all and end-all of Soviet-American relations. Thanks to the Gorbachev phenomenon, there's a sense that dealing with the Soviet Union entails a lot more than nuclear diplomacy now. It entails going to some of the really core issues of what our grievances and rivalry with the Soviet Union are all about. And by the way, I think that's a good thing in some ways.
You know the nuclear clock, I think it's called, that's always a certain number of minutes before midnight.
The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists is keeping us up to date on how close we are to destruction.
Where do we stand on the nuclear clock now, and do you put any stake in that?
Oh, I've always thought it was a gimmick, an understand. I think it's good for people to be reminded that we shouldn't be too complacent. My own feeling has always been that it's exaggerated, that the system of deterrence has worked very well for over 40 years, and there's no sign that it's breaking down. The editors of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists who do the nuclear clock set it back, that is, moved the minute hand a couple of additional minutes from midnight, which is Armageddon, in response to the INF Treaty that was signed in December 1987. And my guess is they would quite rightly set it further back a little more if there were to be a START treaty signed by President Dukakis or President Bush with Mr. Gorbachev in 1988.
I'm always interested in what the psychological effect is on people who work very closely with nuclear issues. You work closely with nuclear issues as a journalist. Now, in describing Polnitsa, you say that he had a bomb shelter on his farm. I always want to know if working closely with nuclear issues makes you more afraid about the possibility of nuclear war, or if it's just, the subject that you cover and you're able to distance yourself from it?
Well, I have found learning about the nitty-gritty, the awful numbers and the frightening technology of nuclear weapons to be sobering and frightening in some respects, but reassuring in others. It's convinced me that the basic premise of nuclear deterrence, that is, the notion that the uncertainties attendant on these weapons are so great that no sane leadership in either country would ever resort to them, is fundamentally sound and durable. So to sum up, I've not, as a result of having studied this dreadful subject for the last 10 years, I've gone out and dug a bomb shelter in my own backyard. I have a lot less room in my backyard than Polnitsa has in his, but I still wouldn't want to do it. I think it would be a waste of money.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Delighted, Terry.
My guest has been Strobe Talbott, who is the Washington bureau chief for Time magazine. His new book is called The Master of the Game. It's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We'll discuss movies and the history of Hollywood on the next edition of Fresh Air. My guest will be Neil Gabler, the former co-host of the PBS movie review program Sneak Previews. His new book, Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood, is the story of Jewish immigrants like Louis B. Mayer and Adolf Zucker, who became the first film moguls and shaped the vision of Hollywood filmmaking. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Playwright Howard Korder looks at TV and sees, in his words, a huge, voracious organism that can eat anything and survive. Coming up, Howard Korder talks about his offering to the TV monster, Lip Service. It's a satiric look at television's triumph of style over substance. Also, now that 60 Minutes has been on the air for 20 years, CBS is presenting a two-part special on the show. Television critic David Bianculli has a review and an appreciation of the program that changed broadcast journalism. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Fields, the new album from composer John Carter and his octet. It's Carter's fourth album inspired by the black experience in America. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Another Eastern Bloc government shakeup, this time in Czechoslovakia. Lubomír Strugal has resigned after 18 years as prime minister. He was considered a supporter of the economic reforms championed by Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. Strugal's departure was announced in Prague by Communist Party chief Milos Jakes during a meeting of the policymaking Central Committee. Strugal's resignation and that of his deputy had been expected. Tamil rebels reportedly killed 47 Sinhalese civilians last night on the island nation of Sri Lanka. The massacre took place in a village about 150 miles northeast of the Sri Lankan capital of Colombo. It was some of the worst violence in the five-year-old separatist war being waged by the Tamils against the government. Details from the BBC's Chris Nuttall.
The latest incidents of violence happened as part of a day of protest called by an extreme group among the majority Sinhalese community known as the Janata Vimukti Peramuna, or People's Liberation Front. The JVP claims the government is anti-democratic and has betrayed Sri Lanka in allowing a 50,000-strong Indian peacekeeping force into the north and east of the island. In its heartland of the south, two people are said to have been killed when helicopter gunships fired on a crowd storming a police station at Urubuka. The state-controlled radio has reported that 2,000 people carried out an assault on another police station at nearby Gandara, in which other reports say five people were killed. 5,000 people staged a demonstration at Hagmana, also in the south, according to the radio, which was dispersed by the helicopters.
Chris Nuttall in Colombo, Sri Lanka. Algerian troops today opened fire on demonstrators in the capital city of Algiers, reportedly killing as many as 24 people. In an effort to stop a week-long series of street protests, Algeria's president today promised wide-ranging political reforms. But he said the economic austerity program, over which riots began last Tuesday, would continue. Soviet Foreign Minister Edvard Shevardnadze arrived in Paris today on a three-day visit, which is expected to set a new tone in Franco-Soviet relations. Lynn Terry has details.
At the airport, Edvard Shevardnadze said Paris and Moscow need to cooperate in a more effective way. Franco-Soviet relations soured in the early 80s over France's support of the deployment of U.S. missiles in Europe and its expulsion of 47 Soviet diplomats for spying. Paris and Moscow have also argued over human rights. But now, with a new leadership in the Kremlin, France wants to improve Franco-Soviet ties. However, the French foreign minister said he won't sacrifice human rights for quick progress on other issues like disarmament. The talks will cover regional issues, disarmament, and French President François Mitterrand's trip to Moscow November 25th. That was announced today, along with another Franco-Soviet summit in early 89. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
In Athens today, a Greek judicial council decided to extradite an accused Palestinian terrorist to the United States. Mohamed Rashid is charged with planting a bomb on board a Pan Am jetliner in 1982. The subsequent explosion over Hawaii killed one person and injured 15 others. A federal court in Manila today rejected a request by ousted President Ferdinand Marcos to return to the Philippines. Marcos had asked the anti-corruption court to let him return to Manila to defend himself in corruption proceedings scheduled for next month. The government consistently has opposed Marcos' return to the Philippines, fearing it would encourage his supporters to attempt to overthrow President Corazon Aquino. Stocks today closed at their highest level since last year's crash on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 9 points to close at 2158.96. Declines and advances were about even on volume of 125 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In 1982, clarinetist and composer John Carter recorded the first in a projected series of 5 suites for jazz octet, evoking the development of Afro-American culture from pre-slavery to the present. The recently released 4th suite brings us up to the black experience in agrarian America. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
British musicologist Wilfred Mellers once likened American music to the sound of an axe in the wilderness, the sound of a new music jury-rigged from existing materials. The beauty of that insight is its inclusiveness. Mellers' vision unites the pilgrims with rugged American types like composer Charles Ives and logging camp pianist Little Brother Montgomery. Composer John Carter's music has the same epic scope. Carter unites oral traditions, gut bucket jazz, and modern chamber music from Morton Feldman to Philip Glass. John Carter is a master of transmuting his source materials. His new album for the Gramavision label, Fields, is subtitled 7 vignettes depicting life during the Fields period in early America. But his sensibilities are thoroughly modern, even where he draws on root musics like the blues and field hollers. On Ballad of Poe Ben, the melody that violinist Teresa Janor sings echoes old work songs, but it gets stretched into something else. John Carter's Fields may flirt with high opera once or twice, but this chamber octet stays loose. Bobby Bradford and Benny Powell play barnyard brass, Don Preston plays oddly human synthesizer, and the drummer is the relentlessly swinging and inventive Andrew Cyril. John Carter's rough clarinet style exploits his instrument's shortcomings. Anyone who took up clarinet in school knows it's prone to squeaks and squeals. But rather than fight that tendency, Carter makes squealing overtones the basis for his style. John Carter extends the rough but transparent textures he plays to the ensemble parts that he writes. Here's some of the 20-minute title track that is the centerpiece of Fields. Fields is the most personal of John Carter's octet suites. It's the first to touch on his own experience, specifically his boyhood in rural Texas. The voices of his singing grandchildren and of a storytelling great uncle are woven into the musical fabric. Fields is the fourth volume in John Carter's series called Roots and Folklore, The Development of American Folk Music. But the progress of the series is more cyclical than linear. The future and the past are inextricably bound together. John Carter's Fields is a metaphor for the way memory works and the way culture evolves. The transformation of the past into the present takes place right before your ears.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. John Carter's Fields is on the Grammavision label. This is Fresh Air. Playwright Howard Korter uses a stylized version of everyday speech to tell his stories. His style has been compared to David Mamet's. In fact, Mamet is the co-executive producer of the TV presentation of Korter's play Lip Service. It's a comedy premiering October 17th on HBO. Lip Service stars Griffin Dunne and Paul Dooley as co-hosts of a local morning TV talk show. Together, they represent the generational gap between the old style and new style of TV journalism.
And when you take in the big picture and you start to see the man, not just as we saw him, but this other being.
That... Warren, that's all we have time for. But what an eye-opener. I'd say you've given us all something to dunk in our coffee this
just
morning.
My point, not only his music.
Exactly. Thanks for stopping by. Come see us again soon.
Thanks, Len. Love to.
Okay. Once again, the book is Elvis, Child of the Skies, and for anyone who's a fan of the late great one,
who isn't,
it's pretty special. I know I'm going to take this copy home and read it under the covers. Gil.
We'll be speaking with 7th Ward Representative Adrian Feldenkraus about zoning changes along Hacker Drive when Sunnyside Up continues.
Howard Korter describes Gil, the older host, as a man who's come to terms with his own mediocrity. He's in his mid-60s and sees himself as carrying on in his own small way the tradition of Edward R. Murrow. Len is the exact opposite. He's all style and no substance.
I think this is a function of where he gets his values from. Television offers a simulation of many things without the messy reality. And he has no need to get into genuine feeling. It'll just get in the way of where he wants to go.
I loved his rap on interviewing.
Am I disturbing you?
No.
I am.
No, I'm just going over the intro copy.
Really? You do that?
Habit.
No, I mean, that's great. You do that, huh? I'm always meaning to.
Not that important. Makes the job easier.
No, no. I mean, of course I look at the quiz sheets. My style is, I like to wing it. You know, take the guests as they come. Mm. Gives a feeling of spontaneity.
I felt like you must have been eavesdropping on certain kinds of interviewers to get that. I've really heard a lot of people say almost exactly that.
Mm-hmm. Well, he would never burn himself with something as trivial as being prepared. he wouldn't let the facts get in the way of being able to make fun of someone, which I think is his basic intent.
Does lip service come out of your experiences as a TV viewer or as a television insider?
My experience in television began after I had written lip service. It was simply as a watcher of entirely too much television. I was pleased to find my imagination of the world corresponded to the actuality. But the thing about television is that it really doesn't matter what you say or do. There's a place where you can be used. Television is a huge, voracious organism, and it can eat anything and survive.
How did it eat you? How did it eat your work?
Writing for television is, at least the kind that I did, which was writing for a sitcom, I found very unsatisfying. One, it's work for hire. I always thought of it as being a sort of a painter in Michelangelo's workshop where Michelangelo would have the big ideas and you'd have to paint the sky, you know, and you'd look at it and go, I painted the sky well, but it would still be Michelangelo's painting.
Was it a disorienting feeling working on television, doing things that you might have mocked before, things that you knew were absurd but that were required?
Yes. I also felt dishonest. The values that most situation comedies, or that really that are prevalent on television, I don't necessarily accept wholeheartedly. The basis of most television is to support the status quo, to really reaffirm common wisdom. I feel these are the very things that need to be questioned very, very closely.
You said you felt dishonest. Is there an example you could give us of something you did that really made you feel dishonest, but you had to do it?
It's just the level at which the stories need to be told. I mean, mm-hmm. First of all, especially on a situation comedy, the characters aren't allowed to change. And what makes writing compelling is, for the writer, is to see where the characters are taking you. They want and need to change, and to take that away from them makes you sort of like a crossword puzzle solver. You know, you're filling in the blanks. Scripts get reduced to mechanical plot devices. I think that's why you see the same stories over and over again on television. They worked once, they'll work again.
I want to talk about how you use language in your play Lip Service. You have people speaking very colloquially in sentences that never complete a thought. It's almost as if sometimes when you have people speaking, they don't want to commit themselves to saying anything.
One thing.
Yes, sir.
Gil Hutchinson. I just want it said. I think he's one of the...
Of course.
I mean easily.
Len, we feel the same way.
How did you start writing in that kind of non-committal type of way?
Well, it's to my mind very close to the way people use language. We believe that we use language to clarify our intentions or to make explicit our wants or desires, when in fact language is most often used to achieve the exact opposite. We wish to hide our intentions.
You know, a lot of people think that to find interesting colloquialisms and rhythms and patterns of speech, you either have to look at certain ethnic groups or at bohemian groups, mm-hmm. or even sometimes people who are poor who have developed somehow this very colorful language or subculture. And you're taking people who are middle-class professionals and finding really kind of interesting quirks in their speech patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about how you started listening for that kind of thing and finding it in a place that you'd expect to be bland and unrevealing.
Well, you know, the basic take on white middle-class America is just that, bland. It's the culture most of us either are part of or have to deal with, and we take it as a given. It's not a colorful speech. It is a speech of blandness. What's fascinating is seeing how we achieve those effects, how we avoid saying what we don't want to say and still say something. It's a point that Gil makes later on in the movie where he says, you speak like a human. You look like a human being. You speak clearly enough, but I have no idea what it is you're trying to say. Len is saying nothing, but he's talking.
I know a problem that a lot of screenwriters have when they're starting out is that they make their dialogue too literary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a problem a lot of writers have in general, that they strive for the dialogue to have the kind of style that you'd give to good narrative, but mm-hmm. people don't talk that way. Did it take you a while to realize that when you were writing?
No. In fact, when I was studying theater and trying to make headway as an actor, every time I'd come across a play that has the kind of writing that you speak of, and most of them do, where some long monologue would pop up in which a character explains everything about himself
for no apparent reason,
I would bristle. And as an audience member, I would just think, we can skip past this. It's not needed. Plays and movies are not like novels. You can plunge into a novel. The writer can go off on a very long digression on the gold trade in pre-Columbian Venezuela, and you can be fascinated for 60 pages. That doesn't work on the stage. The audience likes to be assured that they are going somewhere. They don't need to know where they're going, where they're being taken, but they need to be aware that they are in safe hands and are being taken somewhere.
When you're home writing, is it easy to get distracted by television?
No, I don't turn on the TV during the day. Mostly because there's nothing on that I would want to watch. I've wasted far too much time watching television already to spend any more of it. I think I have work to do. So,
thanks so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Lip Service by Howard Korter premieres October 17th on HBO. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What do you have planned?
Well, this evening we have a special report from the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, Mark Brain. It's an extended report on Yugoslavia, explaining many of the protests taking place there.
Anything special for Columbus Day?
A couple of items. For one thing, we talked with a correspondent in Portugal about a big book that came out this year claiming that Christopher Columbus was not only Portuguese, but a spy for the Portuguese crown, and that his mission was to throw Spain off Portugal's route around Africa to the Orient and mire them in the New World. Also, a piece about the new math of the 15th century.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week and next, CBS is airing a special 20th anniversary edition of 60 Minutes. The show's confrontational style changed the look of TV journalism. Our television critic David Bianculli has this review.
I'm Mike Wallace.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Harry Reasoner.
Good evening. This is 60 Minutes. It's a kind of a magazine for television.
That was the way 60 Minutes opened its very first broadcast, back on September 24th, 1968. It shared a Tuesday night time slot then with the CBS NewsHour, which was the only other nonfiction primetime series on television. The most popular shows that season were Ronan Martin's Laugh-In, Gomer Pyle USMC, and Bonanza. Now, 20 years later and counting, 60 Minutes is still going strong and is celebrating its anniversary by presenting a two-part special. Part 1, covering the show's first 10 years, is broadcast this week. Part 2, covering the most recent 10 years, will be shown next Monday. Why has this TV news magazine succeeded for so long when so many others have died quickly and miserably? Some say it's the charisma of the correspondents. Others say it's the black hat, white hat approach, which has the good guy 60 Minutes crews seeking out and facing down the bad guy crooks and swindlers. Then there are those who say it's because 60 Minutes was the first of its type, and that it manages to balance important issues and topical events with showbiz and celebrity coverage better than any other single hour of television. What do I say? I say it's all that, plus the show's clever writing and even more clever editing. Editing that is either brilliant or ruthless, depending upon which side of the skewer you're on. Mike Wallace's introduction to this week's sampler makes the point perfectly.
We're also not going to do it chronologically. We're just going to wander back and stop off at places along the way. A young Jesse Jackson, an outspoken first lady, a hidden camera, a man up to no good, another man up to no good, the Shah of Iran, maybe the richest man in the world, a musical genius.
That musical genius is Vladimir Horowitz. The show opens just as strongly, with a brief taste of an interview with Richard Nixon, conducted shortly before the 1968 presidential election.
Let me make this one point. Some public men are destined to be loved, and other public men are destined to be disliked. But the most important thing about a public man is not whether he's loved or disliked, but whether he's respected. And I hope to restore respect to the presidency.
This anniversary retrospective is full of memories and surprises, including some classic examples of ambush interviews that, I have to admit, are an awful lot of fun to watch. Mike Wallace was the first openly adversarial interviewer on a major network news series, and his style has become so accepted and adopted that Ted Koppel does it live, and TV's White House correspondents do it on a daily basis. 60 Minutes, though, remains the original article. If it maintains its quality and its audience, then 60 Minutes, like the Stars and Stripes, may indeed last forever.
Do you love this country enough, Maestro, to respond to a request for you to play something that you haven't played in many, many years in public?
Yeah, but I don't know it.
You know what I'm going to ask you?
Yes, I know, because they ask me all the time.
The Stars and Stripes Forever.
But I have to remember. It's so difficult.
I'm sure that it's difficult.
Go ahead.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Conductor Ado de Vart is the music director of the Minnesota Orchestra. On the next Fresh Air, the Dutch-born conductor discusses the joys and frustrations of leading an American orchestra. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers Chicago blues guitarist Mike Bloomfield. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Bird, Clint Eastwood's new movie based on the life of jazz great Charlie Parker. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burton directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.